From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in the history books in middle school, high school, college classrooms. And on a day known federally as Columbus Day, we ask, what kind of Native American history is taught in this country? What kind of history should be taught? And is it time to retire the celebration of Christopher Columbus and join the growing list of American government entities that now recognize Indigenous Peoples Day? A new book explores Native America in a historically accurate, direct fashion. And the book is a textbook written by Michael Leroy Oberg, Distinguished Professor of History at SUNY Geneseo. But in many ways, it reads like a story, the story of Native Americans that most of us have never really read or heard, not at length anyway. It's a book for classrooms, but perhaps a book for all of us. Because Oberg is not here to offer a soothing view of Native dispossession. He's not here to polish up legends and myths. He believes that Native history is vital to understanding American history. It's just the time to discuss this subject on the day that has long celebrated a man who viewed Native peoples as possessions, property to be wielded. My guests this hour include Michael Leroy Oberg, Distinguished Professor of History at SUNY Geneseo and author of Native America, a History. Michael, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
Also here is Peter Jemison, Historic Site Manager at Ganondagan. It's always an honor to have you, Peter. Thank you for being here.
Michael, you're welcome. Excuse me. Evan, you're welcome.
I know. Peter and I go way back. That's okay.
Yes.
It's great to have you, Peter.
What a way to start.
And you know, that's okay. And you know, look, Peter, I've got a list right here. In fact, producer Megan Mack compiled a list of municipalities that the last few years when you've been here on quote-unquote Columbus Day, this list was a lot smaller. I could just go down the list of cities observing Indigenous Peoples Day and not Columbus Day anymore. Los Angeles, Los Angeles County, Berkeley, California, Santa Cruz, California, San Fernando, Burbank, California, a lot out west, Seattle, Olympia, Washington, Spokane, Bainbridge, Minneapolis, Grand Rapids, St. Paul, Denver, Durango, Colorado, Boulder, Phoenix, Ann Arbor, Traverse City. I mean, I'm not going to do this for the whole hour, I promise, but it goes on and on. So it's a growing list, but not federally. How do you feel about that movement right now, Peter? I mean, do you expect to see it locally eventually, and how are you feeling about it?
Well, it certainly is a positive change, I think. I want to start with a quote that I heard yesterday, and which really struck me funny. I was watching the program Sunday morning, and Jane Pauley said, "Tomorrow we will mark the 525th anniversary of Columbus landing in the Bahamas." I said, is there some new scholarship that I am unaware of?
Sounds like a five-star vacation.
So I thought to myself, you know, this is going out literally to millions of people. How many people bothered to call and say, wait a second, that's not the history?
Well, most people probably thought that that's roughly correct. You know?
Right, exactly.
It's in the neighborhood.
It's closed.
Yeah. So let me read a couple of things here. First, I want to read a statement from one of your colleagues, Michael Galbin, the curator and historian at Seneca Arts and Culture Center at Ganondagan. He sent us the following note on Columbus Day. Michael writes, "As a historian, it is my responsibility to educate people about the past. In the case of Christopher Columbus, I simply cannot ignore the heinous acts he committed and paint him as a hero. To gloss over his legacy of bloodshed is irresponsible. On the other hand, Columbus Day has become an opportunity to celebrate Italian-American culture and contributions. This idea I fully support, but could not we designate another to hold in such high esteem? The American public would greatly benefit from becoming enlightened as to the truth about how this country was created, on the backs of slaves and immigrant poor, on the resources from stolen lands, and from the dispossession of indigenous people. This is the hard truth. We must come together to face that history in order to heal those wounds, which we continue to suffer from even today. Let's start with this simple act. Rededicate this day to honor those people who suffered so greatly from the colonization of this land. Let's celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day." That's from Michael Galbin. And I also want to direct you to the blog that Michael Leroy Oberg writes. And as a professor, I think one of the things that's interesting is, you know, you've got this new book, and we're not going to spend the entire hour on Columbus Day because we'll take your calls, that's fine. But we're also going to talk about real history and that didn't just start when, you know, white Europeans came here, that there's real history that's not really explored much at all. And that's what Michael Leroy Oberg is trying to do with Native America. But it's a competitive marketplace. There's people writing different history books out there. And on Michael Leroy Oberg's website, there's a blog that I think offers not only bolstering advice and help for teachers in the classroom, different aids and materials, et cetera, but also your own thoughts occasionally from time to time. And Michael, if you don't mind, I'm going to go ahead and read what you wrote on this subject, then you can tell us more about it. You wrote a piece called A Plea for Justice on Indigenous Peoples Day. Quote, in Native American history, there are lots of guilty parties, but Christopher Columbus is guiltier than most. There is absolutely nothing edifying in the story of avarice, violence, and religious bigotry, save for the Native peoples who at times and places survived the carnage. The continued celebration of Columbus Day does a historical injustice to the Native peoples of two continents and the Caribbean. It is time for the bad history and the myth associated with this day to go away. And if recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day helps, I am all for it. Let's talk about Columbus, to be sure, and the European invasion of America. But let's do so with our eyes firmly upon those Native peoples whose losses were Europeans' gain, and who have endured and survived through five centuries of discrimination, dispossession, and slaughter. End quote. Now, that's an excerpt from what you had to write about it. But as a professor, how do you feel about this growing list? I mean, is it sort of too slow movement in your eyes, or do you have some optimism?
Well, I am optimistic. The movement has accelerated markedly in the past couple of years. I mean, just this week, I think it was Los Angeles County and was it Austin that joined the list of municipalities that have recognized Indigenous Peoples Day. Like Peter and like Michael Galvin, I think this is a positive thing because it's focusing discussion on the history. And as bleak as the news is at times, and if you read the news on Native America, there's the growing attention, certainly in Canada, but now even in the United States, on the problem of missing and murdered Indigenous women. There's a Red Lives Matter movement that is gaining steam throughout the country. There are still state governments trying to skim the cream off of any prosperity that comes to Native American communities, especially in New York State. There are enormous challenges and problems ahead, plenty of reasons to be pessimistic at times. But I think as educators, you know, Peter, I think you agree with this, right? We can talk to people. It's really the skill we have, right, is to write and to speak. And I do believe that by talking about this history, we can refocus the narrative on the Native peoples who were here at the time these first European parties arrived. And I think it's worth keeping in mind that look, Columbus didn't set foot in North America, right? His four voyages here. And if you do look at the Europeans who did come to North America, whether we're talking about Jacques Cartier and the St. Lawrence or Coronado or De Soto or Cabrillo, where I grew up in Southern California, take your pick, right? The one thing that's so apparent in the documentary record is how dependent these explorers were on the Native peoples they encountered. They intruded into Native American stories. Their fates were determined by the Native peoples with whom they interacted. Their effects on the continent were remarkably fleeting. This continent remained Native America up through much of the 19th century, right? You know, the listeners out there, if you go for curiosity's sake, you go read the messages and papers of the president. They're widely available online. The annual messages delivered to Congress by the president of the United States. Well into the latter part of the 19th century, Indian affairs dominated their discussion. Native American history is central to American history. It's not an adjunct. It's not a fill-in. It should be central to the entire story we're trying to tell.
Let me grab our first phone call, because the pushback sounds a little bit like, I think, what we're going to hear from Bruce and Irondequoit. So let's hear it. Go ahead, Bruce.
Hi. I agree what happened was terrible, but the Indians were doing that same exact thing before we got here. So if we're going to teach the full history, let's teach the full history, that Indians colonized other Indians, took slaves, took their religion away from them and made them force them to take on their tribal religions. So these are not blameless people. Now, we as a people had a responsibility to assimilate them, but we tried to take and put our religion on the same way that they tried to put religion on them. The whole century was terrible. They were terrible to Irish. They were terrible to other immigrants. It was, you know, gunslingers. It was all terrible. But the question is how we move forward. And we can't move forward with separate countries and separate this. If it's going to be separate, be separate.
Okay, so
now, I do believe that the U.S. had a fiduciary responsibility to manage their stuff properly, and they did not follow that, and they should be compensated, but not in one lump sum, but education and like that. But you either have to join us or go away. But this whole crying out that, oh yeah, the white man was so bad. Yes, they were, but so was everybody.
Okay, so
everybody was bad.
All right, so Bruce, stay there, please. I want to start with I'll start with Michael Roy Oberg. I know Peter wants to weigh in on this as well. You know what he's saying, Michael, is, you know, if you look at real Native America, and that's what your book is, Native America History, it shows maybe genocide, colonization, slavery, and that indigenous people did that to each other. It wasn't just a white person thing to them. So therefore, that be more accurate about it. I don't know if he thinks that sort of absolves Europeans or what, but go ahead, Mike. What do you think?
Yeah. No, not at all.
Okay.
Not at all.
Okay. It sort of sounds like you kind of think that, but anyway, go ahead, Michael.
Oh, okay, yeah, I think that there's a number of things going on in Bruce's call. And look, no one claims Native peoples lived in an Edenic setting that was utopian. No one has said that. No one has said that. What we do, and Native peoples fought wars against each other. They could be as bigoted as other people. That said, there was a lot of peaceful interaction. There was trade. There was interaction in what became New York State. You have the emergence of the Haudenosaunee in the years before Europeans arrived, which was precisely about peacemaking. And look, how do we move forward? Nothing's going to be accomplished if we continue to deceive people about the past. Look, I have students who've come through the New York schools, who they may know a thing about Cherokee removal from their 11th grade U.S. history. They know nothing about Iroquois removal. They know nothing about why the town they live in is called Irondequoit or Nunde or Geneseo or Cahockton. They have no sense of the fact that the society they lived in, as Michael Goblin pointed out in the excerpt that Evan read, was built upon a systematic program of Native American dispossession. So were white people terrible? Not all of them were. But the consequences of European settlement on this continent were absolutely devastating. We're talking of the deaths of millions of people directly as a product of that colonization. And to throw it back on Indians and say, well, they were bad too, that's not a winning argument.
Before you respond,
Bruce,
stay there. Peter Jemison gets a chance to weigh in. I'm glad you called, Bruce, but wait. Go ahead, Peter.
I like to go back a little bit further to the papal bulls that were issued by more than one pope, and which really promoted what becomes known as the Doctrine of Discovery. The Doctrine of Discovery has sort of as its foundation that Christians have the right to subdue, destroy non-Christians. We, the Native people of North America, fell into that category of not being Christians. Many other people around the world fell into that same category and met essentially the same fate, where the quote-unquote explorer is coming here with what they believe is the word of God, you know, to move that and to proselytize it and to gain converts and to take from the people that they encounter whatever it is that they need. So now, okay, that's the historical past. That's where we started. The problem I have is this. In a recent court decision affecting the Oneida Nation, Ruth Bader Ginsburg referred to the Doctrine of Discovery. So this isn't a past tense. She literally made a decision based on, you know, a notion that is founded in papal bulls of the 11th century, okay? And, you know, and that impacted whether or not the Oneidas got the land, which was taken from them in an unjust, illegal manner. So we're still dealing with this. That's I just want to give you that one instance. The second instance I would refer to, in my lifetime, 10,000 acres of our land was flooded by a dam known as the Kinzua Dam by the Army Corps of Engineers to create a water control program, basically for the city of Pittsburgh, downriver on the Allegheny River. And As a result of that, you know, we lost that land in direct violation of a treaty signed by George Washington, promising us that land, offering peace and friendship. And, you know, a film has just been produced on that subject, which brings it back in an attempt to educate the public about these realities that have taken place that most people are completely ignorant of because of our educational system. There are exceptions. There are schools that really try to reach out, for example, visiting Gunnonagan to come and have a program provided by Native interpreters to help the students learn the true history. And again, this is not in the effort to produce guilt in them. It is simply to try to produce an education that is complete, that is about their country, the country we are sharing.
All right, so let me go back to Bruce. And Bruce, I know there was a lot you probably want to respond to. It sounded like you wanted to jump in on Michael Leroy Oberg's point that, you know, it's not a winning argument to say that, well, they were occasionally violent too. So why don't you go ahead, Bruce?
First off, I don't think Ruth Bader Ginsburg is really saying that Christians can just take away, you know, other people's rights. All right? There are plenty of people who are non-Indians who've had, through eminent domain, their lands flooded.
Bruce, this
is Mike. You can join the chorus of the people that, where the government has gone through and appropriated their belongings and whatever. And I believe in reparation, but you can't have it back. That was done. It's done.
Bruce, Bruce, what Justice Ginsburg said was that the land doesn't belong to Native peoples, even when it does. That's what the doctrine of discovery did, which was spelled out.
That's
in
this, what she said. So
which, hang on.
Not your interpretation. That's what she said.
That's exactly what she said as a Justice of Supreme
no, that's
Court
your interpretation.
Writing. No. Look at the footnote. Look at what the footnote. She cited Johnson v. McIntosh, 1823, the Marshall Court decision, which codified into American constitutional law the doctrine of discovery, which goes back to these papal bulls that Peter Jemison, I think, fittingly mentioned in the context of this discussion. No interpretation about this. This is black and white in the court case. And what this doctrine says is that Native peoples on this continent, this is the legal doctrine, I think it's a terrible doctrine, but this is the law, right? Is that Native peoples don't own the land. What they have is a right of occupancy that can be extinguished essentially at will, as the Supreme Court ruled in the 1955 decision, the Teton decision involving Alaska. This there is a long history here. And look, Bruce, there's nothing divisive.
If the government through eminent domain wants to take it, they will. Join the club.
I'm not sure I heard that.
Yeah, go ahead again, Bruce. What did you just say?
My house sits on a piece of land that the government can come and take through eminent domain. Join the club.
So, in other words, you think that right now you're in a situation no different than what Native peoples faced when it comes to dispossession, when it comes to potential threat.
When the government wants to take it, they take it. Right or wrong, they think the greater good outweighs the individual. If they need my land for a dam or for a roadway or whatever, they take it.
You think it's the same, Bruce, as what Native peoples went through?
Eminent domain.
Okay. That's
it's not.
I got other people who want to weigh in. I mean, but thanks for the phone call, Bruce. I mean, I hear a lot of him saying, you're sort of drawing these parallels. And let me ask both of you. You know, he started with violence. He started saying, hey, look, Native peoples were occasionally violent too. And, you know, therefore, that's what people do. That's history. We got to get over it. We got to move on here. Mm-hmm. You know, Peter, can you respond to that as well here?
Yeah, I mean, humans, unfortunately, by nature, you know, have that side of their character, which allows them to be violent and, you know, which allows them to kill one another. I mean, we just had a horrible example of a human being. And what do we say about that? I mean, do we say, you know, we should condemn all people because this guy did what he did? You know, we try to be, you know, even about this. And look, this is a person which so far doesn't seem as though anyone truly has a profile of, truly understands. I'm saying this is within the nature
Vegas,
of
I'm
human
sorry.
Beings.
Yeah.
And so, Yes. Were there conflicts that were going on this continent? Yes, there were conflicts going on this continent. Was there a message of peace that was brought to us, the Haudenosaunee, in an attempt to avoid killing, to not kill one another, to not create hardship, to not create fear and anxiety and loss and all the rest of it? And that is what we tried to live with thereafter, trying to use that message as a way to guide our life and to guide our children and to guide our relationship with this government that eventually gets established here. So we go through a period of making treaties. The problem we have is that at the present, the Congress can basically do whatever it wishes in total violation of the treaty, so that the word means nothing. And yet, in the Constitution of the United States, it says treaties are the supreme law of the land. So we have to come back to, is this a country of laws? If it's a country of laws, then why don't we apply the law evenly to all of the people who live within its borders and are, by the acts of this Congress, considered citizens?
Michael?
Let's talk a little bit about violence, right? You can read these Spanish accounts. The Spanish ships could sail home from Central America without the need of navigational instruments. They could just follow the floating corpses of Indian slaves who died on the way back. Spanish witnesses described conquistadors burning Indians in groups of 13 in memory of our Lord and his Redeemer, our Lord and his apostles. Conquistadors had contests to see who could cut an Indian captive in half with the fewest strokes of a sword. You could buy human flesh, according to Bartolomé de las Casas, in marketplaces throughout Spanish America. That's the early 1500s. We could jump ahead, right? We could talk about the Paxton Boys, Pennsylvania frontiersmen who broke into a jailhouse to get a group of peaceful Christian Indians who were being protected by Quaker authority. They massacred these people, including some four-year-olds. They hatcheted to death. I can as close as I'm sitting to Peter, you have to get to that four-year-old child and do that. We could talk about Sand Creek, where a major general in the United States Army, or Colorado Militia, sorry, James Shivington, not only attacked a peaceful village that was going to exactly where it was supposed to be, but he murdered the children as well, infants, shooting infants in the face on the ground that nits grow into lice. I could keep going. I mean, there's things that have happened in this history, and I'm not even sure I'm allowed to mention
on
air.
So there's not an equality of violence.
There is not an equality of violence. Look, the pre-modern world was horrifyingly violent by our standard. You know, you walk through the city of London and you see heads impaled on the palisades. That said, to dismiss the violence of European conquest is historically wrong, and here's the
or
other.
Or to draw
thing.
A parallel to what was already happening on this continent. Right?
Yeah, and here's the other thing: is that the conditions imposed by the European conquest, when Europeans marshaled the strength to subjugate Indians, exacerbated the effects of epidemic diseases, which in places wiped out 80-90% of the population. The consequences of the settlement were horrifying, and I think the point that I'm trying to make is that let's talk about Columbus all you want. But let's talk about the fact, not only the consequences of the Spanish settlement and European settlement in the Americas, but also let's talk about Native peoples and the fact that Native peoples have endured this, that they are still here. And that survival. You know, what Europeans wanted was to erase Native peoples, whether that meant assimilating them into the American body politic, whether that meant Christianizing them, whether that meant dispossessing them, or wiping them out. The idea was the same: get rid of them.
All right, listeners, I see phones lit up, and what I want to do here is remind you why we're here, not just on this Indigenous Peoples Day, or if you prefer to call it Columbus Day, as it is federally. We're talking to Michael Leroy Oberg, who is the author of a new book called Native America, A History. It's the second edition. It is a textbook, but I think it's important to point out that I think this is the kind of book that if you make yourself sit down and read this, you'll probably be a better person. You'll probably be a more well-rounded, historically informed person. And that's why I have a lot of praise for it. Michael, where can people find it?
Unfortunately, a lot of it on Google Books. But it's available through the publisher.
You're not supposed to say that. You're the worst marketer.
Yeah, I guess I am. Amazon and all the major booksellers have it. I'm using it in my classes at SUNY Geneseo. So it's widely available anywhere you do a Google search for it.
It's Native America, A History. And After our short break, what we're going to do in our second half hour is this. We'll take more of your calls. I hope that as we take your calls, you know, Peter Jemison, who is an encyclopedia of knowledge, is going to be able to fill us in and help respond to some of your questions and comments in really helpful ways. And Michael, I think, can respond to some of your questions and comments and bring it back to the book here, because we're not going to scratch the surface of this book. Let me just tell you, occasionally I hear people say, oh, you do a lot of work for the show. I am so underinformed on this subject. I am horrifically, embarrassingly underinformed. And we're not even going to scratch the surface of Native America, a history. But Michael LeRoy Oberg will help us occasionally pivot back to some of what we're learning here and how these questions relate to it. So let's do that. Let's get our only break, and we'll come back to your phone calls with our guests here on this Indigenous Peoples Day. All right. And let me tell you what's coming up Tuesday on the next Connections here. Yeah, I'm going to do it live, Rob. That's okay. That's my fault. Let's do it live. How can organizations in the social sector, places like settlement houses, influence systemic change? That's a question Susan Dreyfus explores as president and CEO of the Alliance for Strong Families and Communities. She joins us in studio tomorrow to talk about the root causes of poverty and the importance of settlement houses. Then in our second hour, Salva Dutt is one of the Lost Boys of Sudan and the founder of Water for South Sudan. He's in Rochester discussing his work and a new book written about his journey from war-torn Sudan to Rochester. But first, he'll be our guest on Connections in our second hour. We'll talk to you Tuesday with those shows. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's go back to your phone calls. And Tom in Rochester's next. Go ahead, Tom.
Hey, guys. I'll try to keep my points and comments succinct here. But we're talking about a new book that chronicles American history, Native American history. And Evan, like you just said, you know, a lot of us are very underinformed about the history. And I think when I finished high school back in 2003, I didn't want to stop learning, per se, and I found a book that probably a lot of people have heard, Lies My Teacher Told Me, and that one of the main points that shocked me about that is how textbooks regionally across the country are selected from pools of other books, like publishers will bring these books out, or authors, and it kind of... It focuses on a certain trend of history, a view of history. And then I found the Canandaigua Treaty, a book about, you know, the whole process that was. And that was one of the first treaties with Native Americans that I understand was signed in Canandaigua. I can't remember the exact year, but the effect of the book reminded me that the government did succumb to realizing that they had to deal with the Native Americans in this region of North America, which is a powerful fact. And they're still, the treaties are still honored, as far as I can tell, whether or not blankets and cloth mean anything anymore. But, and then Russell Means' book, Where White Men Fear to Tread, that book really opened up the realization that there still is a cultural population of Native Americans that are more or less in the background nowadays to a lot of Americans. But the thing I want to say about history and the way, say, Europeans view it or the Native Americans view it, we're dealing with it right now with these Civil War monuments being chastised and maybe decided we got to take them down because that's not real history anymore. Well, the Native American people didn't build edifices and they didn't build monuments to their heroes. They passed these stories down through generations and family, and cultural and arts meant just as much to them as, say, accepting a point and arguing for it. And I find that our area is really rich in the Native American history. We had, you know, the Arch Merrill, some of the books he wrote kind of connected me more to our place that we live, realizing that Native American trails were where the thruway is, you know, the Adirondacks were a hunting ground, and, you know, Sodus Bay was a hunting ground for Native Americans. And I go to these places and I walk the trails, and I can live in that history and still appreciate what the Native Americans must have valued, and that was, you know, respecting where they were from and realizing that the land provided for them and that they had to take care of it.
And Tom, let me just jump in and say that you've given us a lot here, and I just want to say he mentioned a couple of different authors, and some of our listeners have said not only they wanted me to reinforce what the book we're talking about this hour is, and then is there a specific book on local Native American history that our guests would point to? The book is Native America, A History by Michael Leroy Oberg, who is one of our guests here. He's a distinguished professor of history at SUNY Geneseo. The book is out now. You can find it. And, you know, so Tom is bringing up a lot of history that he didn't feel like he understood. I think he brought up Arch Merrill. Are there any books on local history specifically, Peter, Michael, that you would point to for listeners?
Well, he talked about the Canandaigua Treaty book. Michael has one. I edited one, too, on the Canandaigua Treaty. I think it's a good one just from the standpoint that here's something that occurred in a city not far from where we all live in 1794. It's ratified by the Congress, by the Senate, in January of 1795. George Washington signs it. So here's something that, you know, is really, I don't know, preeminent in my view in terms of how treaty making was begun. It changes a lot over time. Michael and I could go into that. But at that point in time, there was this notion of two equal parties, two sovereigns coming together and reaching an agreement on how they would live in peace. You know, in this discussion of like how much land we have to give up in order to hang on to some land, and all of those things are, you know, there to be understood and to be learned, and that's a good example of a piece of local history.
Okay, Michael?
I put a bibliography for the book on the webpage, but for Tom, just a good overview. You get the books written by Lawrence Hauptman, Hauptman. Larry spent his entire career writing History of Haudenosaunee People. His books are a good overview, getting you well into the 20th century, well worth looking at. But the bibliography is there. I think, you know, your point about what is taught in the schools, Tom, I think is an important one. We tend to teach, and certainly this is the education my children are bringing home from the schools in Brighton, what I see other kids learning, is a history that Native peoples are part of the past, right? In fourth grade, mm-hmm. you can walk down the street in my neighborhood on trash day after the Iroquois longhouses are made, right? And you have this is what we study, the Iroquois longhouse. We cover a little bit in 11th grade U.S. history, but it's the Cherokee removal and not the local history. I find this so deeply disturbing. For the same reason I find things like the Washington Redskins logo disturbing and children dressing for Indians, like Indians for Halloween, disturbing, because what it does is when you consign Native peoples to the past, it makes it easier to ignore their legitimate grievances today, and it places Native peoples in a position where quite often they have to prove their identity, unlike any other ethnic group in the United States. And as Peter's comment about Canandaigua was getting at, what you have is not just ethnic groups, but Native nations, right, who under U.S. constitutionalism, the political existence of these entities predates the Constitution. That's acknowledged. That's why it's a nation-to-nation basis. That's why the instrument of treaties was used to negotiate and work out agreements with Native peoples.
All right, so listeners, again, if you want to call the program, questions or comments as we talk about Native America, a history, 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI. If you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Tom in Greece next. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering something I've been wondering about for some time concerning this topic, was about Columbus's voyage. When Columbus, the genuine Italian, and his Spanish crew landed on the island in the Caribbean, and they saw the native people there, okay, it was the native people apparently looking or meeting the Europeans for the first time. How did they communicate with each other?
Thank you, Tom. Go ahead, Peter.
Here is a part of this story, which I think it becomes you know, a part of maybe the second voyage. I'm not sure it was a part of the first voyage. Requirimento?
That was 1503, yeah.
Yeah. So when they come, the Spanish are obligated to do this. They're obligated to announce their presence. They're obligated to announce what they're there for. And they're obligated to announce to the people that they are about to encounter what their expectations for them are. Now, this is all in Spanish, remembering that the people that they're speaking to don't speak Spanish. So, yeah, it's a very good question. How did they actually, they communicated through brutality, unfortunately. They communicated, they acknowledged that these people were totally unfamiliar with a steel weapon. They cut their fingers because they didn't realize that these were sharp, that they were actual weapons. But this was what, you know, they would announce that we are here and you have a certain amount of time to get all of these things that we want you to bring to us. Everything of value that you can get your hands on, please bring it to us now. And this is so, when you think about this, it's so ridiculous. First of all, they may not even be within earshot, but they're secondly, speaking a language that the people they're speaking to have no knowledge of.
That's right. I think that another element of that is what you see, and certainly in English America, you see Europeans scrambling to learn native languages. Diplomacy, even we're talking about Canandaigua, right? In 1794, this is 200 and some years after Columbus has arrived. What you see are Europeans, Americans, scrambling to find the wampum they need to conduct diplomacy according to Iroquois Treaty Protocol. So even when they're speaking in English, they're going through interpreters, right? And what it's you know you hear Timothy Pickering, who's George Washington's Secretary of War for a while, but negotiated the Canandaigua Treaty, speaking of clearing paths and drawing eyes and opening the throat and opening the ears, using the language of the condolence ritual to communicate with Iroquois Haudenosaunee people, and I think that's important, is that. Look, Europeans in general, this is a big generalization, but in general, Europeans came to North America, the Americas, for three reasons. They wanted to get rich. They wanted to secure a foothold on American shores so they could go after their European enemies. And they wanted to spread what they saw as the one and only true religion, to do all three of those things. And they said this time and time and time again, to do all three of those things least expensively and most effectively, they needed the cooperation of native peoples. They didn't get it because of the kind of people they sent to do the colonizing, these soldiers and mercenaries. But they recognized that hostile native peoples are not going to trade with them, are going to burn plantations, destroy settlements, that hostile native peoples will team up with your European enemies against you, as the English, and it's this whole part of New York is a testament to that, and Peter's people, right, with playing the French and the English off against each other. And then finally, although the Spanish tried to do this as they sprinkled holy water on native peoples who were burning, in the Protestant world, you could not convert to Christianity the same Indians you were trying to kill. It required catechism and required teaching, instruction, dialogue to get people to accept the faith. Europeans had to learn to speak native languages to get that done.
And here's where I would say that the translators became very valuable. Yeah. They literally had people that they wanted to go and live among the Mohawk, or people they wanted to live among the Seneca, to become fluent speakers so that in the future they would be able to communicate and carry on transactions, including treaties, because there were people who could understand the language, could speak the language. So, you know, this comes about later, but as you point out, this is a requirement that they also learn the diplomacy, and this is where the English were very skilled. They learned the diplomacy, and they practiced that, as you were talking about, the exchange of wampum. And the words that they were using, and so many symbols that they recognized, made it easier for them to carry out transactions. Sir William Johnson being one who was very skilled at this.
For some reason, when I hear Tom's question on how they communicated, my brain went to again something I'm learning anew. I'm going to mispronounce some things from your book, but can you first set us up with the story of Uncas?
Yeah.
So tell us who Uncas is, and then I want to read from your book a little bit here.
Yeah, Uncas was a leader of the Mohegans in 17th century Connecticut. The Mohegans themselves were a product of some of the epidemic disease and warfare that predated European settlement or Anglo-American settlement in southeastern southern New England. And what Uncas did was create a place for himself, become one of the most powerful native leaders in 17th century New England by pitting different English communities against each other and maintaining enough strength such that the English feared that if they angered him, they would have a problem too great for them to deal with. And Uncas was sort of a master at this intercultural diplomacy.
So you write about the massacre of the
Pequots. Yeah.
Pequots. 400 and, between 400 and 700 Pequots died in the fires of Mystic. Why don't you just describe a little bit, and then I want to read, Michael, but what happened in that sense there? I mean, just horrific scenes, it sounded like.
Yeah, the Pequots were enemies of the Mohegans, and essentially Uncas enlisted different English colonies in a conflict. Both the colony of Connecticut and the colony of Massachusetts, colony of Plymouth Plantation, all three of them all wanted a piece of the Pequots' land, which was vital for the production of wampum, the shell beads that were used in intercultural trade. Forces from Connecticut and Massachusetts surrounded this fort at Mystic, tried to fight their way in, couldn't do it. It was a palisaded settlement. They decided to withdraw as a captain, it was either Underhill or Mason, I can't remember now, but as they decided to withdraw, the English officer said, we must burn them. And what they did is they set fire to the fort, encircled it, killed anyone who was lucky enough to escape from the fires. Between 400 and 700 Pequots died in that attack, and then over the subsequent months, many more Pequots were hunted down and destroyed.
So this is why
they made it illegal to call yourself a Pequot,
yeah.
And they pursued them to the islands off of the North Atlantic, in order to wipe them out, basically.
This is why I bring this up, because I think of Tom and I think of Bruce here. Tom's asking, how did they communicate? Well, not often very easily, but then once communication was established, Native peoples saw a difference here. Bruce is trying to create this parallel. Well, yes, white Europeans came, it was violent, but, Native peoples were violent, and ultimately, the white Europeans had bigger guns. That's sort of, sorry, Bruce, I'm oversimplifying. That was kind of the gist of Bruce's call. The difference is Uncas saw something different here. It wasn't just, well, our people can be violent, they can be violent, I'll enlist them. It was a different level of this. And let me read from Michael's book. Quote, "The English manner of warfare, the region's native peoples learned, was grotesquely violent. The Narragansetts described the English way of war, which involved the indiscriminate slaughter of men, women, and children, as naught or evil. They fought savagely. Uncas learned that the Puritan desire for vengeance was great, their capacity for violence was extraordinary, and that they would not hesitate to destroy those people who stood in their way and to enslave those left behind. He decided that he would work to remain a friend to the English." Can you blame him? So it's not a parallel here, at least from what I'm learning from Michael's book, from Peter, from the lessons we've learned in history. I'm trying to be open-minded here, but Bruce and others who want to draw this parallel, it's not a parallel. Peter?
Well, my thought was this. The Pequot were trading partners of the Seneca because the Pequot were engaged in the manufacture of wampum beads. The wampum beads become the beads that we use in creating wampum belts, which are mnemonic devices in order for us to record important decisions, important agreements, in order way to send a message which is a true message by sending wampum. And this is what we were talking about earlier, how the English eventually fall into this pattern of using this type of diplomacy to work with. But, the part that struck me is that the Pequot were basically almost annihilated. And when they finally, kind of come out of the ashes and create one of the largest casinos in the Northeast at one point in time, suddenly they're like faced with a kind of overwhelming wealth, right? And then have to deal with that, all the things that kind of propelled. It's a remarkable story, but it's a story that is largely unknown. Another one of those stories. Largely unknown, and I agree. I have to say, Evan, that the level of violence and the violence which is directed at a civilian population versus a warrior-to-warrior type of a conflict or a conflict of matching armies, if you will. This is what we're witnessing here is indiscriminately all of the members of that community are inside of that palisade are the target of that.
torturing and murdering children, women. But Michael, let me also ask you, you know, in thinking about that level of violence, one of the things that we have learned from sociologists, from researchers, from people who conduct all kinds of research into really tough, you know, sort of sad levels of violence is it's harder to brutalize, to torture, and to kill somebody if you're close to them. That's why it's easier if you're a soldier to drop a bomb from 30,000 feet than it would be to kill possibly civilians hand to hand. We know that. It's also easier if you think that they are less than you to otherize. So I wonder if do we have enough historical evidence that says the white Europeans, wherever on this continent, looked at the native peoples as less than them, so easier to brutalize, and how did the native peoples tend to view white Europeans, less than them, or, you know, possible equals, or how did that relationship work?
Well, it's a hugely complicated question.
Yeah, I know there's not a pat answer.
Yeah, generally the best that Europeans saw in Indians is that they might be able to become like them, right? That as one. English promoter of the Jamestown colony in 1609 wrote, "It is not the education of men, but the education of men which makes them barbarous and uncivil. And therefore, you change the education of men, and they will become civil." That said, when the Jamestown settlers kept pressing and pressing and pressing upon Indian lands, and the Indians finally attacked in 1622, that same operation, the Virginia Company of London publishes a poem where they describe the Indians of errors of nature, of inhumane birth, the very dregs, garbage, and spawn of the earth, who never were mentioned with those creatures Adam gave name to in their several natures. Throw them off the ark, right? And I think, look, to come back to this theme, right, there was enough violence to go around. Violence in warfare between native peoples and Europeans was vicious warfare. It was intimate warfare. It was warfare between people who quite often knew each other, who communicated with each other. It was sometimes warfare that fell upon the most easily accessible Indians. Bacon's Rebellion in Virginia in 1676 was about Indian fighting. The Susquehannocks and Dogues, who were the peoples actually attacking Virginia settlements, were out of reach, so they just fell upon the remains of the Powhatan chiefdom and wiped them out. Similarly with the Paxton Boys, the problems were Shawnees and Delawares, who were farther out in the western parts of Pennsylvania. They're inaccessible, so these guys went and slaughtered Christian Indians who were essentially placed in a prison to protect them. Native peoples, there's a range of opinions too, right? And certainly in the colonial in all the documents, you can see this in the colonial period. There's some that said, look, they have powers we don't have, the ability to withstand disease, this technological stuff that we can't explain that made them seem willing to adopt certain elements of European culture. It's not a sellout in any stretch of the imagination. Others like Neolin and Tenskwatawa and others who looked at Europeans and saw that our problems come from associating with people like this, and that we can either separate ourselves from them or attack them. But it's a huge range of opinions. Mm.
So we're down to our last couple of minutes here on Indigenous Peoples Day, federally known as Columbus Day. Michael Leroy Oberg is the author of Native America, A History. It is a textbook, but it really reads in a way that is accessible and important. And Michael has pointed out you can find it on Amazon. Yep. And you can also get on his website, especially if you're an educator. But if you just want to learn more, follow his blog. The website is, Michael?
MichaelLeroyOberg.com.
MichaelLeroyOberg.com. Piece of cake to find that. You can always find Peter Jemison at Ganondagan. Peter, some final thoughts from you on this Indigenous Peoples Day that you want to leave the audience with.
Yeah. 1964, io vivere a Siena. I was an exchange student in the city of Siena in 1964. Part of my reason for being there was to study the Rinascimento. And there are some amazing artists who could be the heroes who we could celebrate. Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Paolo Uccello. We could go on and on with, very great artists. Marconi. We could make mention of many different people who have made significant contributions. I wish we could direct those thoughts to that celebration of, you know, the Italian-American heritage, which is so much a part of this country. And they suffered that discrimination. They suffered, you know, hangings. And they worked very hard in the fields and were not accepted and went through all sorts of things. I'm aware of that. And, you know, and I have an appreciation for that. So I kind of want to leave that word that this is what I'm here to talk about is not against Italian Americans. It is to try to share some of our true story, which is so lacking in the studies that your children and my children went through.
I think that is a beautiful way to end the program. And I appreciate that. You can see Peter and the wonderful people at Ganondagan at the Seneca Arts and Cultural Center. And he's right. I mean, a lot of families, people may be hearing that saying, why is he talking about Italian? Because Columbus Day has become kind of defended in some places by Italian Americans. And so Peter's saying there's lots of great, much better examples than a man who sort of brought genocide. Peter, always great to have you. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much. And Michael Leroy Oberg.
Thank you for the invitation.
You got it. Michael Leroy Oberg, we'll talk to you again. It's Native America History. Congratulations on the book, and thanks for doing it.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Audrey Sample, intern, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We're back with you Tuesday on member-supported public radio.